right now on the Daily Debrief. A family breaks down after pleading.
Don't take one more from us. This family can't take it.
As prosecutors seek a death sentence against a man convicted of killing his kids.
Let the punishment fit this crime.
The jury recommends a sentence. Is it life in prison or death? Also, are the relatives of a murdered family going too far on the witness stand?
That was attacking my colleague, Mr. Moline.
And a confused expert under attack in a Florida triple murder. The Daily Debrief recaps the day in court. It's Thursday, June 13th.
Welcome to the Debrief this evening. Ann Bremner in house along with Bob Bianchi. We need someone to separate Bob and I. So let's get straight to it here. A sentencing recommendation in South Carolina as a jury there determined late today whether Timothy Jones Jr. shall live or die. The jury found Jones guilty of punishing his son to death and then systematically killing his four other kids as they found out. The jury rejected an insanity defense and also rejected a chance to convict Jones of being guilty but mentally ill. Here is the reading of the sentencing recommendation.
We, the jury, in the above entitled case, have found beyond a reasonable doubt the existence of the following statutory aggravating circumstances, to wit, two or more persons were murdered by the defendant by act or pursuant to one scheme or course of conduct, and the murder of five children, 11 years of age or younger. Now recommend to the court that the defendant, Timothy R. Jones, Jr., be sentenced to death.
The clerk's voice trembled. The defendant barely flinched as he learned the jury wanted him to die. The defense also barely reacted. The Jones family, which also, of course, is the family of the victims, broke down in court. They did not want this. During closing arguments, the prosecution told the jury that this was a serious crime which should have serious consequences.
More horrendous than what you've heard when you came into this courtroom. Let the punishment fit this crime. The defense asked you when you were jurors up there, prospective jurors, before you were sworn in, did you reserve death for the worst of the worst? Yes. All of you knew that's the big penalty. My question is, isn't he the worst of the worst? Tim Jones, a man who brutally murdered his five children. He is a mass murderer. He committed the most heinous crime a human being can commit. He not only took a life, he took the life of a child, five children, who had trusted him. They called him daddy. Is there any crime worse than that? He betrayed their trust. He chose himself over them, and they paid with their lives.
Something almost chilling and ghoulish when you hear it said that way. The prosecution then, yet again, took the jury through the deaths of the five children. Here is some of it.
Dad's made a decision. He's done what you folks are going to have to do. He deliberated. I'm a one-man jury. And I have before me life and death. He sentenced his kids to death. And as a judge, the sole judge in that house, he entered that decree, and then he became the executioner. He comes to Eli. Eli, who's been loyal. And what are Eli's words? Dad, take me with. Is that how he spoke? Or are those hands already on that child's neck? He's pleading. Dad, I haven't abandoned you. I'm choosing you. Take me with you. Dad's already entered the decree, death. He squeezes that child's neck so hard it breaks that hyoid bone. He grabs Mira. No, no, no. He looks at her in the eyes. Does he give her mercy? She makes one final appeal, trying to find the dad inside the beast that has his hands on her throat. Daddy, I love you. And he hears that and he crushes her neck, chokes her. holds her till she is dead. Mercy? And then why? All right, these kids can speak. They can say what happened. Why the two younger ones? Why Gabe? He's not going to talk to the police and Abigail. My gosh, she's just a year. No one else gets my dream. If I can't have these kids, no one will. Not Amber, not my parents, no one. This is mine.
Wow, that's a big performance. The defense asked for sympathy on account of the Jones family.
How much more death does the Jones family have to endure? How many more funerals does this family have to go to? How many more tears do they have to shed? How much more heartache do they have to endure? Each one of you will decide that. And I can't imagine being in Tim's position after what he did and the amount of pain and suffering he has inflicted on these people that he loves. Because if I were him, I'd be terrified that I had become unlovable. These people that supported me were going to turn their backs on me because of what I did, and I wouldn't be able to fault them if they did. And Tim is so fortunate that that's not the case for him. He's so fortunate that he has this family that are standing by him despite the absolute horror that he has inflicted on this family. And so under these horrible circumstances, how do you punish severely while showing compassion and mercy for people who still love Tim, for people who loved Mira, Eli, Natan, Gabe, and Elaine?
That argument from the defense came after the testimony of a number of relatives who said they did not want to see the death penalty inflicted in this case.
When I look at him, I'm more mad that he didn't ever call me, because I feel like I failed him as a sister, because he's always been there for me, and when he needed me, I wasn't. And that's what I told him. I'm like, I'm not mad at you. And, you know, I even forgive you. And because the Timmy I know isn't capable. You know, the Timmy I know is full of love and compassion. Nothing's going to change my mind about him. He's my brother. I love him. He's never stopped being my brother. I've never once shown or hid away from the fact that he is my brother. And I've already lost him. You know, I'm not getting him back. You know, I will never be able to bring him home for Christmas dinner so he can meet his niece, or, you know, let him hold her or anything. And I can't lose him completely.
Do you want him to be put to death?
No.
Another relative had the same request to save the defendant's life.
Do you want him to be put to death?
I do not. I know what he did was horrible. He took 5 of our family members. If you guys don't take one more from us, this family can't take it.
Can you stay in touch with Tim in prison?
I would love to. I would love to. Every day, any minute, I'll talk to him. He's my brother. I love him so much, you know? Just like anybody else has a brother or a sister, even though they did something super wrong, at the end of the day, you love your family. And you love your brother and your sister, no matter what they did.
With us tonight is attorney Ann Bremner from Seattle, also Bob Bianchi here in studio. So, Ann, I was watching that prosecutor's closing argument, and I thought I was watching one of the scariest horror films I've ever seen. Did he study acting? I want to know.
Right.
I think the performance sealed this deal.
I did, too. He was fantastic. And what was that line that he had, finding the dad within the beast? Yes.
And then he'd move to, like, basically, you know, annihilate one of his daughters. It reminded me, remember Clarence Darrow and Leopold and Loeb? I mean, it's a very old case. But he talked about, shall we temper justice with mercy and love? And he spoke for, like, 2 days with complete eloquence about saving the lives of two murderers. He tried both together. And I thought about that. So eloquent, not a lost word. The savagery, we could feel all of it, and we would be basically moved as a full jury unanimously to find for death.
Bob Bianchi, you were a former head prosecutor. Would you have moved forward with a death recommendation? Would you even ask for it over the wishes of the family, who, keep in mind, it's not just the defendant's family, it's the family of the victims as well?
Yes.
You would have.
Absolutely. I think that he said it best at the press conference. He understood her position, but, you know, it was a wobbly position, Aaron. We talked about this before, where she said, I'd like to rip his face off, but I got to be very careful what I say here. I don't want to be responsible for the death. And I thought that that was very telling, because I think the jury turned around and said, don't worry about it. Will be responsible for
that. That's the mother. You've got all the rest of the Jones family saying, you know, hey, look, we want to keep this guy around. But Ann, I think there was evidence here that this defendant tried to evade punishment. He was looking up legal websites, places that didn't have extradition treaties.
Right.
I mean, it seemed like he wanted to get away.
Yeah, he did. And then he had the kids' bodies in his car for like 9 days. I mean, then you always see this too in these cases, or maybe it's just on TV, but this is, of course, on TV here, this trial, is that he's crying for himself. You know, you see that he doesn't really cry much about any other time in the case or about what's happened. But when his sister's talking about him, like, I can't have him for Christmas dinner, he's like, you know, about, you know, poor me.
That is sad.
Yeah, it is.
We'll check in with the panel again later on in the broadcast, because now we're going to head to the penalty phase of another case where the state wants to put a convicted defendant to death. After 5 months of testimony and 22 hours of deliberation, the jury convicted Chase Merritt of murdering all four members of the McStay family. The defense focused on a series of unknown DNA samples inside the family's graves and unsuccessfully argued a number of other points of doubt. Brother Michael McStay waited more than a week to check on the missing family, despite pleas from others to do something sooner. Here, he describes a so-called drop-dead date when he would act if he had heard nothing. He also blamed the press for aggravating his family's loss.
Did you have reason to believe that they may not be okay? And were you thinking about that?
I was concerned at that point that there was problems, yeah, but, you know, that's why the drop dead date was the 15th. So my mindset was really just to see if I could reach him.
What was the role of the media in your life after February 15th, 2010?
They won't leave you alone. I mean, they call and call and call and call, and they're just relentless. They don't care about getting the truth or getting it right. They just want ratings. So I figured out a way to, you know, keep the story out there as much as I could, you know. So I figured I'll just use them like they're using this, and hopefully, you know, somebody will see something, somebody somewhere. I mean, you can't have four people just disappear off the planet and not somebody see something. So, you know, not to be truthful or anything like that. Just, you know, they want whatever, I'll talk to whoever, whenever.
Other testimony from Mike McStay led to the following discussion, motion, argument perhaps, outside the presence of the jury.
Defense brought it up to make sure that people inform their witnesses, not to direct comments at the defense. Mr. McStay did 3 events of that, and we didn't object. We told the court we didn't want to look like we're objecting in front of the jury, but we take exception to that, and we ask for the court to admonish the people to ensure that their clients comply with that order. The first statement was when he said he was taken by him, referring to my client, which is a reference and an attack on my client. The killing of them was for what? Money, gambling, such a joke. Again, attacking my client. The third was, at least you didn't delete the file. That was an attack on my colleague, Mr. Moline, who had an issue during closing. So now he's actually belittling or making fun of counsel. And in response to that, Mr. Imes actually encouraged it by saying, yeah, that's kind of true. So I believe, based on the prosecution's duty to make sure that witnesses do not volunteer any statement that would be admissible, they're in violation of that. So I would ask the prosecution to uphold their duty and admonish them appropriately.
The court said one of the comments went beyond proper victim impact testimony, so the state is hereby warned. Still ahead on The Debrief, yet a third death penalty trial, this one in Florida, as one defendant faces a jury on accusations he showed up uninvited to a party and killed three people. That case is after the break. And before we head back to court, Chief Investigative Correspondent Brian Ross is here with a look at what he is working on tonight. Brian?
Good afternoon, Aaron. Coming up tonight, sex crimes and war crimes. First, the story of the leader of a fundamentalist church with 5 million members worldwide, members in every state in the United States, now accused by California authorities of the rape, the statutory rape, of 3 teenage girls in his parishioners. He apparently told them, according to prosecutors, to refuse him was to refuse God. And then the story of war crimes. Decorated Navy SEAL Eddie Gallagher goes on trial next week, accused of killing an Iraqi who was part of ISIS and randomly shooting at innocent civilians in Iraq. He says he's being persecuted by the government for doing his job. His lawyer will be here to talk with us live. That's coming up right after your program, Aaron.
Great, Brian. We'll see you then in just a couple of minutes. Florida prosecutors are seeking a death sentence against 2 defendants accused of showing up to a party with guns and masks and murdering 3 people. Christopher Visada is the one on trial right now. He's accused of murdering 20-year-old Kelly Doherty, 26-year-old Sean Henry, and 24-year-old Brandy Al-Salhi. Police found Visada collapsed on the road about a mile away from the shooting scene. They say he was carrying a glove, a magazine, and a bullet. A pathologist who examined the victims' bodies faced this cross-examination about some confusion about the number of bullets.
During the deposition, when you were asked that, you answered that at least 12 that are separate wounds that we know definitely came from separate bullets, right?
Yes, that's what's my answer.
Okay. Different than today?
Pardon?
Different than today?
I don't think the questions are the same.
Okay. And I understand that in this case, you're having a difficult time because of the number of gunshot wounds determining what's an entrance, what's an exit, if this is connected to that one or whatever, right?
You were shot multiple times.
I understand, ma'am. I understand.
I'm going to probably count sometimes the exit wounds as an entrance.
Okay.
You know, I may have given different numbers. I may have counted some exit for entrance. But I don't see the point of the question. Would you please tell me if that's a mistake you pick up from this report?
I don't know if it's a mistake or not, ma'am. I was just asking the question.
He was shot multiple times. He was shot twice in the head. There are fatal wounds. He was shot multiple times in the body, and several of those wounds are fatal.
Yes, ma'am. We understand.
That's
we just
crime.
Cover that. So, and just so I'm clear, your counting today was 17 separate shots, correct?
I counted 17.
Okay.
Yeah, but maybe if you give me the time, I'll count another number.
Okay. And at the time of the deposition, under oath, ma'am?
Yes, I went through the same thing and went through wounds, you know. I don't think that's the
important. Doc, just pause there. Wait for the next question, please.
Okay.
And, ma'am, at the deposition, your answer when asked was 12 times. Is that correct?
That was the answer you asked me, and I said 12 that were definitely. Let me see how I answered that.
One of the responding officers described discovering the bodies of the 3 victims.
I saw a male and a female that were laying on the ground. When we first got in the backyard, this female, she was face down in the fire pit. So when we walked around, I was still holding the shield, and I was facing the house. I was still pretty much the most forward officer in our group. And as we started making our way towards the victims, I noticed the male victim laying down, the female with her face was in the fire pit.
Was there a fire going?
There wasn't a fire, but it appeared that the fire pit was still smoldering.
Despite being face down in that fire pit, was she moving at all?
No, ma'am.
That officer said he saw no immediate signs of life. Another testified about coming upon a bloody and injured defendant.
Yes, he had an injury to his groin area.
Was there blood?
Yes.
At this point, do you know anything about what the shooting that's happened on Mohawk?
No.
Okay. And so you have no idea whether he's a suspect, victim, what has happened to him?
I have no idea.
Okay. And as a part of you rendering aid to someone who is visibly injured, do you inquire of them to try to get information as to what happened to them?
Yes.
Okay. So what did you ask him?
I asked him what happened, and his response was...
Overall.
You can answer.
His response was, they shot me.
Did you ask him who?
Yes, and he said, I don't know, I blacked out.
And what happens when you go inside of his pocket?
I feel what I know to be a magazine to a firearm and a loose bullet.
Returning now, our attorneys Ann Bremner and Bob Bianchi. So, Ann, this mix-up between the 17 versus the 12 bullets, is that ultimately a big deal or not?
Yes and no. I mean, of course, we know there's 17, but the fact is that she did say 12 in a deposition. So does it make her not as credible? And remember, she was kind of hamming it up a little bit on the stand, which I think we both kind of looked at each other like, that's a little bit weird. But maybe she's just nervous. But it undermines her a little bit, but not completely.
You know, I have to wonder, Bob, when you've got two defendants, one on trial right now, and this mix-up about the number of bullets, one defense strategy may be to turn around and say, well, look, some of these may have been fired by the other person.
Yeah, I mean, the reason the prosecution put this witness on was to try to explain to the jurors how the entrance and exit wounds occurred, how many bullets were fired, and hopefully they're going to try to tie it into the ballistics down the road as to which guns they came from. So this is a big issue, and her flippant attitude in front of the jury, I can assure you, if I were a prosecutor, I'd be sitting there, I'd be seething and waiting for a break so I could do a little rope-a-dope to her and tell her, just answer the question.
Yeah, I mean, that's where I was kind of going with this, because I'm sitting here saying, okay, you know, I want to know exactly how many were fired and by who.
Right, exactly. And she kind of did the grimacing and laughing and everything else. And didn't the judge admonish her a little bit?
Answer the question, yeah, slow down. Yeah, the court exactly. reporter needs to get something. And
yeah,
it was that. Right? Yeah, exactly. Right. It was that little message, like you better notch it down a little bit here.
Exactly.
Maybe her reaction, as you said, was just sort of a nervous response.
Yeah, well, she's been like this from the beginning. The minute he got up to cross-examine, she got very tense and very aggressive. And the bottom line is a defense lawyer loves this because now I get to make it about you as opposed to my client.
Exactly. We're going to wrap up. And Bob, great to see you in-house
today.
We're so glad you joined us tonight. Our live trial coverage resumes tomorrow morning. The Debrief will be back tomorrow at 5 Eastern. Good night. Now gets to ascend to the throne.
I never did.
I thought you did.
No. Nope, I did not.
Where'd you come from before?
ABC and NBC before that.
That's right.
Yeah. All right.
Oops. It was a pleasure meeting you.
Nice meeting you.
There's nothing down there like lipstick or anything, is there?
No. An old IFB, I think, was, yeah.